We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Among the industrialized nations of the world, no country has a higher murder rate than the United States, and that has been true now, roughly speaking, since about 1900. A lot of explanations have been offered. For example, people say, well, it's about easy access to guns, or perhaps it's about things like poverty, unemployment, about substance abuse, and there are certainly others. Our guest for this first hour of the show, historian Randolph Roth, says that really none of these explanations work if you try to take the long view of American history. Furthermore, he says, if you look at the murder rate in America over time, it's constantly fluctuating. It goes up and down. And he has a novel way to account for this ebb and flow in deadly violence. He says that more than anything else, people's feelings about government, their connections to their communities and each other, their opportunities to earn respect without violence, all of those things contribute very significantly to murder rates in this country. If you're interested in reading in great depth on this subject, you should look for a book that has just come out by our guest. The title of the book is American Homicide, and it's published by Belknap Harvard Press. Our guest, Randolph Roth, is professor of history at The Ohio State University, and he's joining us this morning by phone. As we talk, questions from listeners are welcome. We just ask people to stay focused on the topic and please be as brief as you can. That way we can get as many callers in as we can. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that would be good for you if it would be a long-distance call. You use that number and then we'll pay for the call. And that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, it's 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. And at any point here, certainly questions from listeners are welcome. And Professor Roth, hello.
Hello, David.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. Well, I suppose to start, just to talk a little bit about where we are today, and acknowledge the fact that actually very recently there's been an interesting downtick in homicide. And I don't want to come back to that, but just roughly to speak about where we are now, certainly the difference between the United States and the rest of the industrialized world is really dramatic. You have a graph here in the book that plots it out where you can see that right away. The next closest country in terms of homicide to the United States is Canada.
Yes, we've been a bad influence on them, I'm afraid.
And that's probably, yes, it's probably, you know, so it's like they used to say about Mexico, you know, so near to the U.S., so far from God.
Right.
And their rate is about a quarter
that's
of
right.
ours.
Ours is stunningly higher.
So what, in terms of numbers, what is the
what are
homicide
we
rate?
At?
Yeah,
well,
what are we looking at?
For two-thirds of the 20th century, our homicide rate was 9 per 100,000 persons per year. And those rates can sound awfully small. It means that, really, there's only 9 out of 100,000 chance that you'll be killed in a year. But you have to but what we understand as researchers, and I think what we all understand as Americans, just knowing how dangerous our society is, you're exposed to that rate your entire life. So if our homicide rate were to stay at 9 per 100,000, for the next 78 years, it means that one of every 142 children born in this country would be murdered. Hmm. That would be roughly one out of every 460 white females, one out of every 160 white males, one out of every 110 non-white females, and one out of every 27 non-white males. Today, we've been for about the last 15 years at 6 per 100,000. But what that means is that roughly one out of every 200 children born in the United States will be murdered if we stay at that rate. And when you think about the damage, the heartbreak of murder, how it, you know, all of the loved ones of the victim and even the loved ones of the perpetrators, they're all devastated. by this event, and that lasts them a lifetime. Mm-hmm. So you look at the kind of damage that this homicide rate does. It's tremendous, and it's human toll. And as you said, you know, Canada is the next closest to us, which is just a quarter. And most nations in the world have homicide rates, or affluent nations have rates of 1 or 2 per 100,000 or even less. Mm-hmm. So we really stand out as unique.
And what then makes us more interesting, though, and starts you thinking, is when you look at what's happened in the United States over time, that, first of all, that if you go back, before the Civil War, roughly speaking, that then our rates don't look that much different from, say, rates in Canada or Europe.
In fact, they were lower. We were probably, you know, again, it's hard. We have a lot of work to do on other nations. But it's beginning to look like, say, from the War of 1812 down to the mid-1840s, the American North and the Mountain South may have been the least homicidal places in the Western world. And although the South had become more violent since after the Revolution than it had been in the 18th century, its homicide rate still was much lower than it is today. So it's stunning to see that in our past, we were not that homicidal. And, of course, different homicide rates react differently, too. I'm going to talk about this in a future book, Child Murder in America. But what's extraordinary is how up until in the 18th and early 19th century, what a wonderful place we were for children as far as violence was concerned. You know, that is that kind of murder by parents or caregivers, is the one kind of murder that does tie to the economy and economic opportunity and your ability to realize your ambitions. And because we were such a wealthy place for the middle class and the poor, relatively speaking, all those opportunities, we may have been the safest place for children on earth. Mm-hmm. So, and we're not that at all now. We have a relatively, for affluent nations, our murder rate of children has also gone up. So these are very complicated questions.
Yeah. And just, and I suppose it, for people who are listening, we ought to mention that it, essentially for the purposes of this conversation and for the data that you look at in the book, mm-hmm. when we talk about murder, what we're talking about is murder involving unrelated people.
Thank you for saying that. You're right. I should have mentioned that, because what's fascinating is that different kind of murders follow different patterns. As I said, the child murders seem to go, murders of children by caregivers do tend to go up and down with the economy. So we are seeing a kind of increase, at least there's indications right now with the economic downturn. We're seeing an increase in murder suicides of entire families or violence against children. But as you mentioned, the rates among adults have gone in a very different rate, unrelated adults. And we know, too, that intimate violence follows very different patterns. It follows the patterns of gender relationships, about the balance of power between men and women within relationships, within the economy, within marriage, which follow very different patterns. So what we're talking about, where America stands out, what makes us distinctive, is the level of homicide among unrelated adults since the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. And even if you, also interesting, if you, say, look at the period since 1900, which is this period in which our reputation for being a murderous country, when you're talking about what we're talking about, it really gets established.
There,
it's interesting that if you look at the graph as you have plotted it out over that period, that period between 1900 and 2000, what you have is something that looks like two mountain ranges with a big valley.
That's right.
In between, and you see particular places where it really goes up and down, and that where there are significant declines. For example, it looks like there was a big decline in the murder rate from, it looks like maybe about from 1930 to 1950 or the late 40s, and then again, say maybe, oh, like around 1958, 59, something like that. There's also a big trough, and then it shoots way up again, and so we get these peaks in, looks like maybe like 70 and 78, and maybe in around 1990. So again, you have to look carefully at what's going on, because you get, over time, you get these big peaks and valleys.
You really do, and of course, that drop that you see in the middle of the 20th century really dates to the second year of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's presidency, 1934, is when it starts to drop. And it drops steadily right through the New Deal, and you drop, you keep low or dropping through World War II. You keep dropping through the Cold War right into the early, you know, late 1950s, early 60s. You said there's some flat places in there, but the trend is just down. And what's startling is that by the late 50s and early 60s, at least for white Americans, our homicide rate was down to 2 per 100,000 per year. It was getting down towards where we would like to be. And although the rate for non-whites was much higher, you know, maybe 10 times higher, it had dropped significantly from what it was in the early 20th century, in the mid-20th and the early 1930s. So we were headed in the right direction, and it fits into this kind of theory that, you know, I've been talking about. You can really see that what happens is it's one of the ironies of the Great Depression, that we think that the economy will be the key, but once Roosevelt came in, and really started to capture the imagination of the poor and the middle class, those who are most likely to commit murder or be murdered, and started to say that, you know, this government cares about you. You're empowered. The creation of unions and having a third of all Americans empowered in those unions by the early 50s. The sense of national cohesion and purpose that came in with World War II and the Cold War, that sense that we are one people. And so, and I think what you see, it took 25 years of strong leadership and largely successful bipartisan foreign and domestic policies to build trust to the level it attained in the late 50s and the early 60s, and a real willingness on the part of the American people to support policies that entailed great risk and enormous sacrifice. The irony is the government was asking more of people. We're going to ask more of you in taxes. We're going to ask you to risk your lives. These are fundamental, important things. And what the irony of it is that, you know, that created a lower homicide rate by increasing trust in government, by increasing the legitimacy of that government, by building a stronger sense of nationality that ran across racial lines and ethnic lines and religious lines. And you'll see, too, that there was not a sudden progress towards racial equality, but there is that painful and painstaking progress that happens especially in the 40s and 50s as Roosevelt started to integrate certain aspects of the war in the defense industries when Truman integrated the armed services. It's interesting that the drop for non-whites was most significant not between 1934 and 1941, but when the policies really started to benefit them and the union movement started to open to minorities in the 1940s and 50s, and that's when their rate dropped. So you can see that these kinds of broader things, that feeling about the government, that feeling about your fellow citizens, the feeling about society. And it's profoundly interesting that those unions were very important for getting a sense of empowerment, that this government has my back, that I have some voice, that I matter. And what's interesting, if people have that feeling, they don't walk around with a chip on their shoulder. They don't want to walk around with a kind of hostile or defensive feeling towards their fellow Americans. And it plays out in taverns. It plays out you know, where people just don't get into deadly tavern fights. They don't rob and murder each other. It's just stunning to see how that kind of emotion has such a dramatic effect.
Yeah. And just real quick, I have a caller here. I'll get to them. But just so, again, to turn that around, something that really struck me here very, very early on. In fact, you look at the work of another academic, a criminologist, a man named Gary LaFree, and in which you mentioned the fact that his work, in a sense, says sort of the same things.
Yeah, we were working, and his work really, we were working independently on these things and discovered it independently, and his work on legitimacy fits into a part of my theory,
You write here that of all of the variables on which social scientists have collected data in the past 50 years, homicide rates among unrelated adults in the U.S. have correlated perfectly with only two: the proportion of adults who say they trust their government to do the right thing and the proportion who believe that most public officials are honest. When those things are high, the murder rate goes down. That is, when trust is high, the murder rate goes down. When trust is low, the murder rate goes up.
That's right, and it even tracks separately for African Americans and European Americans. The homicide rate black trust in government was at its lowest between 1971 and 1974. And that's when their homicide rate peaked in the post-war period. And for whites, their homicide rate peaked in 1980 at three times what it was in the late 1950s and early 60s. And that's when white trust in government was at its lowest. That accumulated anger about busing, affirmative action, welfare, the defeat in Vietnam, the humiliation of the hostage taking in Iraq or in Iran, it just came to a head. And what's fascinating is when the Republicans took the Senate and took the presidency and Reagan came in, you see white trust in government go up and you see the white murder rate go down dramatically. In the first 4 years of Reagan's presidency, as dramatically as the homicide rate dropped in the first 4 years of Roosevelt's presidency. Hmm. It's a stunning thing to see. And it really, that correlation explains, for those who are statisticians, two-thirds of the variation. It's stunningly close. Hmm. The other number that's fascinating to me that I've worked with is over the long term, the best correlate of the homicide rate among unrelated adults in America from the 1640s right through the 1920s is the percentage of new counties in any decade that's named after national heroes. That's true for British heroes in the colonial period. It's true for American heroes in the American period. It's kind of an unconscious way of saying we believe in our country, we believe in its leadership, we believe in each other. When you name things after Washington and Jefferson and Jackson. And it's stunning to see that that number is the one that correlates the best, just the way you see these polls that we've had really since the 1950s correlate so well. So it is a stunning thing that it has to do with feelings and beliefs more than with the particulars of poverty or unemployment or how many police on the streets. As we said in the 1830s and early 1840s, we had no police departments outside of the urban South. Yet still you see, and we had very small prisons and rudimentary law enforcement, yet we had a low homicide rate because there was that sense that we were a great nation doing great things, going in the right direction. That feeling was so strong in the North and the Mountain South that those feelings, that defensive and hostile attitude, just wasn't there.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Randolph Roth. He's professor of history at The Ohio State University. And we're talking about some of his ideas, and you will find them in a lot of other information about murder in America over American history. You'll find that in his book, American Homicide. It's published by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press fairly recently. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore, in the library. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free. 800-222-9455. Here's caller. Here's been patient. Go to line one in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Very interesting subject. I was wondering in your research if you've been able to tease out or determine where in this country our homicides are different than other nations and in what degree. As an example, I doubt in this country there are very few husbands who murder their wives because the husband's family demands a greater dowry from the wife from the family of the wife, as it happens in India, or honor killings and things like that. And mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that probably worldwide the homicide rate, one spouse killing another is, we're probably not all that much different. But perhaps one area that where our homicide rate is different than other countries, and say the homicides that occur in relation to our ongoing problem with dealing with narcotics and drugs and so on and so forth, and the curious effects that come from that. And I guess to sum up my question is, how are we the same as other countries worldwide or first world countries, and where are the places where we're, if we are, and I'm guessing we might be, dramatically different?
It's an excellent question. It's about the different kinds of homicides, signature homicides. And, when we compare ourselves to Great Britain or France, we see everywhere more drug-related crime. we see more gang-related crime, say, since the 1960s, 70s, and 80s in all of those nations. So that kind of problem is going up, I think, everywhere. And there's tremendous concern about it. And as you're saying very well, there's a lot of problems that we just don't have, those kinds of dowry murders. Another one we don't have that was rampant in France in the 19th century was murdering your father. Because what they had a system where, you know, the eldest son inherited and the younger sons didn't, and it led to some real bad feelings in these families. And you see those kinds of, and we just did not have that with what we call, you know, more equal inheritance. The thing is, though, what we found, and I've really counted these out for the 19th century and the 18th century, we haven't got the good data yet to look at specific kinds of crimes in the way that we want to, even with the FBI data. But what you'll find is that almost all of these crimes among unrelated adults, the bar fights, the gang fights, the drug-related things, alcohol-fueled things in the 19th century, they go up and down together with these political phenomena. As far as domestic violence is concerned, you know, we like most nations did not have a high rate of lethal endings of marriages or romantic relationships up until the 1830s and 1840s. And where you're quite right too is when that rate increased, when marital violence increased and romance violence increased in the 1830s and 1840s in the northern United States. It did the same thing in England. It did the same thing in northern France, the places that were developing economically, where women were getting more economic independence, where the balance of power was shifting towards women. And so even though the average relationship became better, you know, less violent in a non-lethal way, those men who couldn't make that change to the new companionate marriage and accepting a greater amount of autonomy and rights within marriage for their spouses, they became more violent and became more lethal. But again, it's not a pattern that you just see in the United States. You see it everywhere. So I think it's a great question that you ask, and I think you're quite on the right track.
All right. Let's talk with someone else on a cell phone here, line 4 on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, very interesting topic. I was surprised by the dramatic difference between the U.S. and other countries. I was wondering whether you looked into the comparison between media glamorizing some media glamorizing crime and also the entertainment industry, which seems to be glamorizing crime in some ways too.
It's a good question, and the thing that, you know, there are people who've really worked on that, and historians have thought about it, and it's stunning the degree to which the mass media in Great Britain, in France, and other nations sensationalizes violence to every bit the same extent as our media do. You read 19th century newspapers, which I have in Great Britain and France, and it's stunning. You know, the murder and the macabre and is right there in the front page, atrocities. And they're reporting them not just in France or England. They're reporting them from around the world. In the United States, the newspapers are doing that too. They're reporting not only on sensational crimes in the United States, but in England and France, anything that they have that's sensational to sell papers. And you will see right from the 19th century, you'll see that some murderers are deeply influenced by this. I can tell you of one murderer, a spouse murderer, Patrick Gray in Vermont. He threatened his wife, and he said, I'm going to do to you exactly what so-and-so, I forget what the other guy's name, did to his wife. And he had read about this in the newspaper, and it's true. This other fellow, a county over, had murdered his wife brutally, and this guy a year later did exactly the same thing to his wife. So there's a learning curve here, I'm afraid, you know. So there is a little bit of contagion here, absolutely. But I don't think that – I think that the media sensationalism has been constant since the 1830s with the penny presses around the Western world, wherever the literacy rate has been high. But we've seen – you know, as David said, the homicide rate keeps going up and down and up and down, even though that sensationalism has been there in the newspapers first, then, of course, on radio, and then on television and the movies.
Let me ask you about one other factor before somebody else does, because I'm sure that it would come up, or it would not surprise me if it wouldn't, as an explanation for the high rate of homicide, and that is easy access to firearms.
Yeah. We have always been a very gun-owning nation. I think our best, we still have a lot of work to do on this, but our best estimate is right from the 17th and 18th century, roughly, you know, well over half and maybe even 60% of all households owned a working gun. So guns were everywhere, yet, as we said in the 1830s and 40s, we weren't very homicidal. And we do remain one of the most widely gun-owning nations in the country. So I think that, you know, guns, as we see these homicide rates go up and down, even though gun ownership has been steady and high, we have to say that the primary factor in homicide is these other feelings and beliefs. But what's interesting, and I have an article that I hope will be published soon on just this issue, one of the key transitions where guns became part of the problem, not the major problem, so I want to choose my words carefully, especially to my friends who are, you know, very responsible sportsmen and shoot, target shoot and hunt. The key is that muskets, the muzzle-loading muskets, were very hard to use as murder weapons because with that black powder, which is liable to absorb moisture, which is liable to corrode a barrel, you can't keep that gun loaded for long periods of time. You've got to keep it unloaded most of the time. And although on the frontier, to be safe, you would put that gun over the mantle because, you know, it's hot and dry up there above the fireplace, still those guns would just corrode and the charge would get wet and it wouldn't work. So what happens is you find that spontaneous violence, say household violence, murders among slaves, indentured servants, masters, mistresses. You look at marital violence, romance violence, in the era in which we had muzzle-loading guns. Almost none of those relationship murders, household murders, were committed with guns. And you'll find that when the murder rate among unrelated adults is high, the proportion of murders committed with muzzle-loading guns reached about 40%. It was fairly high because people were coming to political confrontations angry and armed. They were coming to property disputes angry and armed. Those emotions were coursing through them. So they loaded their guns to go and fight. But when the homicide rate was low among unrelated adults, the percentage of homicides committed with muzzle-loading guns went down to 10% because people weren't carrying those guns around loaded. They weren't looking for trouble. What happens when you get the modern breech-loading guns, as you do with the new Smith & Wesson Model 1 in 1857, which is a tremendous advance in firearms? It has that self-contained bullet where the powder is sealed in an airtight, watertight case. So you can keep it loaded indefinitely. And so what that means is that you can carry that thing around, and it's always ready to go. And as you see the muzzle-loading gun stock replaced with the breech-loading gun stock in the second half of the 19th century, you'll see that the percentage of homicides of all kinds committed with guns just goes up and up and up. Mm-hmm. Even though the homicide rate is dropping in the late 19th century, it continues. The homicide rate among unrelated adults goes down in the late 19th century, but the percentage of those murders committed with guns keeps going up and up and up until around World War I, when the gun stock is replaced. 70% of all homicides are committed with guns, and that includes romance murders, marital murders, murders among unrelated adults. And I think that having that weapon there that is so lethal is very dangerous, the same way the habit of carrying swords and daggers in 16th and 17th century Europe, going around armed with that and being ready to use it, made it increase the lethality of disputes. So although I would really fight against the idea that guns are responsible for our problem, it's the great political crisis of the mid-19th century that made us a homicidal society. But what guns do is putting them into these very charged situations and having them loaded all the time is a very dangerous thing because it increases the lethality of confrontations that otherwise would happen with fists or sled stakes or rakes or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're a little bit past our midpoint here. Again, our guest is Randolph Roth, professor of history at The Ohio State University, author of the book American Homicide. It's published by Belknap Harvard. We have some other callers here. We'll get on to them, but please be brief. We're moving into our last, say, 20, 25 minutes, and I'd like to get in as many callers as we can. We'll start out with somebody here who's on the road on Interstate 74 outside of Peoria, or was when they called here. Line number one. Hello.
Yes, hi, thank you. Dr. Ross, just to talk about what you said, so in your research shows that after the Second World War, there was a significant drop in the homicide rate. Does it stand to reason that after the First World War, there was a significant increase if you compare the American psyche post-World War II to what it was after the First World War and getting back to the distrust of government or the feeling that government wasn't doing anything for them?
You are absolutely right. And what's stunning is Illinois' homicide rate in 1919. It has this huge spike where I think it got up to something like 40 per 100,000 adults per year in 1919, that terrible year of violence. Of course, we know the terrible race riot in Chicago in 1919, but that was just that's just a few of those murders. It was all over the state. Some of it, of course, was prohibition. But all across the nation, you'll see a gradual rise there, particularly in the South and in the industrial North and Midwest. You'll see a rise. The Western states were still coming down from their very high levels in the frontier period, and the Western states don't really return to the rest of the nation until about the 1930s. So they're still going down from that long, those very high peaks of violence in the 19th century. But you'll see in the South and in the Midwest and the Northeast, you see that, and you'll see the same thing, interestingly enough, which fits your theory. This happens in Weimar Germany. You see a spike when the German government collapses, and you see the deep polarization and anger between the National Socialists and the Communists and the Socialists and the Christian Democrats and a high level of political assassination and violence. The murder rate spikes from 1917, and it's high right down until 1933 when Hitler comes to power. And you'll see a spike in Italy from 1917 to 23 in that post-war instability until Mussolini comes to power. You see a spike in Belgium, which suffered a terrible occupation. And they have that spike, too. And it's not just about, you know, political violence or lawlessness and brigandage. It's all kinds of murders my friends working in Belgium have found. So when this kind of political anger, political instability, polarization, a lack of feeling that your fellow citizens are on your side and are one people, just you'll see these catastrophic homicide rates. So in that post-World War I period, the rates were higher in Western Europe than in the United States.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that that's really it's interesting. Again, it's a dramatic, I think, example of what you're talking about. If you look at these periods, no matter where you're looking at it, either the United States or other places, periods of political instability have high murder rates. I think it's also really interesting you talk about what happens on frontiers. Those are also places where you can see very high rates of murder. You see it, for example, in the American West, and that and if you look at places that were frontiers, you can still see it. It continues over time.
Yeah, it's especially where you know you have essentially a hostile military takeover or conquest where the original inhabitants remain, like you have in South Texas, where you have that hostile political takeover, you have those conflicting, you have that ethnic conflict, you have government instability, you have deep divisions, the homicide rate can remain high for a long time. What's sad to note is in places where the frontier is violent, but in the end, the European Americans simply expel or wipe out the Native American population and really establish political order, rudiments of law and order very quickly, the homicide rate on those frontiers can drop very dramatically, very quickly. It's not something you really want to know, but it fits with these other parts of the theory, yes.
Well, let's go to up in the northwestern part of the state, Pawpaw, line four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know, it's kind of interesting. It's like you're picking on the gun owners. I'm not a gun owner, but you know what? The fact is, if we took all the guns out of America completely, you would still have gun violence because the gangbangers and the people that are doing the crimes are getting guns from the black market. It's a known fact. Most law enforcement agencies would tell you that. Now, is that going to stop the wacko, the mentally ill from getting guns? No, I mean, and I actually am a firm believer. Now, I don't have guns. but I'm a firm believer that people ought to own them. And most people, I think, or most people in this country are very respectful with that, and they're law-abiding citizens.
Well,
but I don't get.
Yeah, actually, I don't really think that it's true that the guest was picking on gun owners.
That's absolutely not true. I shoot myself. I'm a scout leader. I taught my son how to shoot. I teach all my boys how to shoot. That's what I do. And you're misrepresenting my argument. I said it increases the likelihood of lethal violence to have something that is as deadly as a gun in a difficult situation. But I said very explicitly that guns are not the fundamental cause in any way of our nation's high homicide rate. I believe deeply in the Second Amendment myself. I think it is an individual right. And I have many friends, who are gun owners and members of the NRA who, you know, I just don't understand your response to my argument. What I am saying, though, as you can well imagine, and gun violence is simply not limited to the criminal class. That's a common argument. And the fact is that we see domestic violence committed with these guns. We see relationship violence. And in fact, then in the 19th century, the kind of homicide that was most likely to be committed with a gun, far more than any other, was a romance suicide, where a young man, I mean, it's a rare kind of homicide, but where a young man was distraught, he was rejected by his lover. And we didn't see these homicides before the 1830s and 40s. But when in the 50s and 60s, when you bring in that repeating revolver, and what they do is with that revolver that's always loaded, they can stalk their victim. That's when stalking begins, with Smith & Wesson's invention.
Yeah.
And they stalk the victim, and it's a perfect weapon. They ask the woman, will you come back to me? And she says no. And he pulls the gun, and he shoots her, and shoots himself. And he almost always shoots the woman in a way that won't disfigure her. He's in his own mind in love with her. He'll shoot her through the heart. He'll shoot her through the back of the head because he wants it to be quick. He doesn't want her to suffer. And then he shoots himself in the head, and that's it. You can't do that easily with a knife. You can't stalk somebody with a muzzle-loading weapon, but you can do it with a revolver. And that's all I'm saying. You know, this is not to say that these young men, weren't motivated by other things. I think that the independence of women, I think the new romantic movement, which suggested that you're destined for one and only true love, which is a dangerous idea, these guys took this to heart and became dangerous. But I think that these kinds of weapons do have an effect, just as I said swords did and daggers did when they were carried commonly in the 16th and 17th century.
Yeah.
It's not just about guns. It's about carrying a weapon that is very, very deadly and dangerous, that is designed for a specific purpose. And I'm not at all blaming this, and I know you don't. There are places in our country that have very high rates of gun ownership, like Vermont, New Hampshire, and extremely low homicide rates. And I have a lot of friends up there. I've worked on that. And they're very conscientious and very safe with their firearms. So it's just, what is driving homicide rates isn't, always do we have guns. But I think guns in certain situations make things more difficult. And again, we bought these firearms, these repeating firearms, because we were in the midst of a terrible homicide crisis in the mid-19th century. And that's why people felt the need for these, for protection. And the problem is when you buy them for protection, you end up using them against your own people. This happened in the American South after the Civil War. The rate of the percentage of homicides committed with guns jumped after the Civil War. And a lot of young blacks and young whites bought guns to protect themselves, or for the white point of view, to keep blacks in their place. But take a look at who those guns were used at. They were whites who killed each other with guns at a higher percentage rate or equal percentage rate that they use guns against blacks.
Mm.
And the same is true for black-on-black violence. You buy that gun to protect yourself against somebody else, but you're using it against your friends. You end up using it against your acquaintances because you're carrying it and it's so easy to use on impulse. So again, this is a problem, and I think all gun owners know that. I mean, the first thing that we teach our scouts is that this is a wonderful tool and a very dangerous tool, and you have to respect it.
Mm. Yeah, about 10 minutes left. Again, our guest in this hour of focus is Randolph Roth. He's professor of history at The Ohio State University, and we're talking about some of what you will find in his book, American Homicide, which looks at the history of murder in the United States and tries to answer this question, why is it that compared with other industrial countries that the United States, particularly since about 1900, has had the highest murder rate? And he says a lot of the conventional explanations, some of the things we've talked about, really don't work, particularly if you try to look back through all of American history. But he says there are some things that do correlate very highly with periods when homicide is very high, and on the top of the list are the way people feel about their government. Do they feel it's legitimate, that it's doing its job to make sure that there is justice? And it also has a lot to do with how people feel about their community. Do they feel connected to it? And do they feel connected to each other? So if you'd like to read, there's a lot of material here. It's in great depth. So if you want to read more, you look for the book. We'll go on here to talk next with someone in Effingham. This is line two. Hello.
Hello. Thank you. This is more of a historical question.
Yes.
Or statement, the rise of decayed paternalist society and evolved over the last 40,000 years until the Industrial Revolution and the events after that, and how guns, and I agree with you that the guns play a huge part, and look at the world today with two wars here and others scattered everywhere, and that's been the paradigm for 500 years. Mm-hmm. And how is it possible that we are going to overwhelm the kind of social activity that the gun provides, and which you have articulated very well, and whenever it gets to personalized, and then people can make their own war against each other, their friends, or people they don't like, then it is another symptom of patriarchal society as we have known it now for at least the last 6,000 years. Yeah. And I don't know if your book addresses those things or not, but thank you, David. I'll hang up and listen on a radio.
Okay, great. It goes back to the middle of the 16th century, but not before then. And we are working on the medieval period and thinking about that. But we have a global bioarchaeological project I'm a member of where we're looking at human remains way back to look at these kinds of patterns. What I would say is I just ask you to remember one thing, that as we said, by the late 1950s and early 60s, even though we had a very high rate of gun ownership, what you find is that our homicide rate was down to only about 2 per 100,000 per year among whites and European Americans, and the total homicide rate was down to 4.5. So it's possible, even with high levels of gun ownership, to have that number drop. You know, would it have dropped farther without having as many guns in the society? I think so. But I think we can get a long way, a lot very close to a low homicide rate, even being an armed society, is one of the ironies of it. It's about those feelings a little bit more than it is about, much more, I think, than about the weaponry. And so that's where I'd have to end on that.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to Champagne next, line three. Hello.
Yes, hello. In the book Freakonomics, mm-hmm. The author basically says that one of the correlations between a decrease mm-hmm. in violence in the last couple of decades he claims the correlation is with abortion, with
right.
the presence of legal abortion, because now women who, you know, normally would be having these children because they couldn't have an abortion and would be mm-hmm. resentful or maybe not economically able to take care of them well or whatever, mm-hmm. now those women have other options. So mm-hmm. these children are not born who grow up in these negative environments and go on to, mm-hmm. you know, have mm-hmm. negative adulthood. So can you just comment on that?
Oh, I commented on it in the book, and I'd be happy to. I'm a great admirer of Stephen Leverett's work, but I don't agree with this particular part of it. And I guess, you know, there are very technical reasons. There are some great papers that have been written, and he that to show that he made some errors in his calculations and assumptions. And I know that he has actually acknowledged a number of those. So the pattern that he saw wasn't as strong mathematically. But what I found is that the abortion rate went up tremendously in the mid-19th century. Abortion is not a new thing. And oddly enough, before the late 19th century, people just didn't understand much about reproduction and life. So their thought was is that before quickening, before a child kicks, say fourth or fifth month, it's not really in any way a living thing or a potential human being. And so they didn't have as many problems morally, although many people did, with abortion. And you find, I mean, there are estimates, and I think they're a little high, but as many as one in six pregnancies ended in abortion by the mid-19th century, a tremendous increase in the first half. I think that may be too high by a factor of three or four, but still you see a really strong increase, not only in evidence of abortion, but in evidence of abortion related to deaths that peaks around the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. A good number of women dying in botched abortions. I think in Philadelphia, I think one of every 1,500 young women between the ages of 16 and 25, we can demonstrate died in a botched abortion. So abortion was common. And what happens is those abortions peak in the mid-19th century. They start rising in the 1840s and 50s. What you see is that the homicide rate is very, very high in that period. It's spiraling out of control. And I think that it's very easy to take a single event, which is, I think, the flaw in the kind of thing Freakonomics does. It doesn't look at several historical events to see what the relationship between abortion and homicide rates are. It takes a look at just one, and you'll see that those who believe in concealed carry laws dropping the homicide rate also follow that same period. The homicide rate dropped in the mid-1990s. And so if I can find I could find a number of correlates that broke in just that period. One is that first generation of children being old enough to be aborted. Another one is the rise of the concealed carry laws that allow people legally to carry concealed weapons. And so, you know, you'll see people say, I've got one set of data, one historical circumstance, one change, and you run a single set of data through it and say, this is what I've proven. The way you need to do social science is through history. You look at a number of cases, a number of instances, a number of societies over time. And when you look at more and more societies over time, you can see that the rate of abortion really doesn't correlate 10 or 20 or 30 or 20 or 30 years later with the homicide rate among unrelated adults in those societies.
Okay. We'll try to get one more caller at least here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I was curious as to whether those in current American society, those who are actually committing the murders, whether there's any data that speaks to that they have been trained to problem solve in a very violent way, such as people in the military, in police, even some violent sports. So does violence beget violence, essentially?
Well, that's a very good question, and I must confess that I haven't, you know, personally studied that. Although you can take a look at societies where you have a high percentage of young soldiers and young sailors, port towns. You can take a look at frontiers where you have a high percentage of soldiers, and you'll see that, yes, you see quite a bit of violence in those places, and it is that group. I'm afraid soldiers and sailors have been pretty violent all along. And whether that is because of their training, whether that is because they're really away from home and don't feel a connection with the people around them, which is part of it. I mean, one of the interesting things of looking at New England in the late colonial period, you'll find that when the homicide rate is low there, young colonists, men, don't rape or murder or rob and murder their neighbors. But British soldiers, British sailors, British sea captains come into our port towns and rob and murder Americans and rape and murder young women. There's a disconnect, you know, I don't feel you're one of us, that's driving that, as well as, you know, that training perhaps. But I am concerned that when the homicide rate spirals out of control, and you can see this when you really have a state breakdown, you're absolutely right, people learn violence and become violent. Take a look at the violence after the Civil War. So many of those robbery gangs, like the James Gang, like the Lee Gang, they were all guerrilla, Confederate guerrillas, and they learned to kill, they learned to be ruthless. And they were so deeply alienated and angered after their defeat that they turned against everybody, even former Confederates, and robbed and murdered them. So I think that, you know, but there the toxic connection is not just the training. It's the it's that training tied to political alienation and political anger that really leads to the kind of violence we see from former members of the Confederate Army in these gangs after the Civil War, and as we see in Ku Klux Klan violence, which we know is heavily associated with former members of the Army.
I can give you about a minute here because we're just have about that much time. But if we wanted to really do something about the murder rate, and it suggests, what your work suggests, is that some of the things that we always fall back on aren't going to be as effective as we'd like, what would be effective?
Oh, dear. It's a very hard thing, you know, and as a social science historian, I really work on trying to understand rather than think about causes. Mm-hmm. And I'd really love to hear from your listeners and from everybody after reading the work that my colleagues and I are doing, Gary LaFrie and others are doing, to think about it. I think we all have to think about what we could do better. You know, I thought a little bit in the book about political leadership. I think that when you have a politically calm time, or when there are grounds for really national unity and pulling things together, you know, divisive political leadership, name-calling, efforts to delegitimize the other side, to question their patriotism, I think they can be destructive and destroy trust in societies where, in fact, most government officials are honest, where, in fact, the government does do a pretty good job in many ways. And I think that's very, you know, in many ways true of today. I think the grounds for political unity are greater. But in terrible political crises, even the greatest political leaders can't have much of an impact. I think about what a great centrist political leader Abraham Lincoln was. He tried, he looked at things from both sides. He understood the South, the white South. He understood the African-American South. He understood the North, how Democrats, how Republicans felt. He just was a compassionate man and a far-sighted man, and he said, can't we solve this? Can't we find some way to pull back together? And he ended up being a murder statistic himself.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. A very interesting book, a lot here. If people would like to read more, look for American Homicide by our guest Randolph Roth. He's professor of history at The Ohio State University. The book is out recently from the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. And Professor Roth, thanks very much.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.